A couple of points that I wanted to make that came up during the most recent break is apparently several other people use Java 8 features, which is perfectly fine, but you got a failed compile message and the TA didn't realize it was Java 8 and not some more fundamental problem that was causing an issue. So if you're using Java 8 and you got a message from the TA about this not compiling or this not running, just send them email and explain that you were running Java 8 and you believe there's nothing wrong with your program. It's simply the incompatibility between 7 and 8 caused issues. And I'm going to see if I can find some way for him to run 8 on something or other, maybe a private machine or something. But basically what just happens is the department has a policy of having a standard level across all the machines so that they don't get all these crazies that it worked on one machine and not another, as you could imagine. And we use Java in lots of courses. So we're currently at 7 because, as I said, some early problems with Eclipse going to 8 simply made people back off. I'm sure we'll go to 8 eventually, but that does not change your situation. So particularly since you're almost done with Project 2, you say, oh my gosh, that may be the same issue. At a minimum, in your README file, say, oh, by the way, I use Java 8. And that means if he sees any compilation-like problems, don't assume immediately that it's problems with your code. It should simply be the 8 versus 7 incompatibility. And for future jobs, 3 on, if you can go back to 7 and it doesn't cause you any programming issues, that's probably the safest thing to do, because for sure 7 runs on the machines we have. And are there any changes between 7 and 8 that are that fundamental that we really need them? See, at least one head saying yeah. Okay, what I'll be doing, so at least that warning now, and I'll see if we can find somebody who's got a Java 8 thing running. There's lots of people who have their own private machines and just get a load on that. Or maybe, I guess he'd have to be the only graduate student in computer science in the world who doesn't have his own laptop. So it's just a matter of telling him, you know, install it on your laptop and use it. And that'll probably be enough to do it. So it's a temporary problem. We also had a question about late days. And again, late days are the honor system here. And in some cases, we had people had serious issues with family health problems or job-related travel or whatever. So you get to decide if a late day is your problem or not. So if you need extra time and that's because something beyond your control, like family issues, health issues, job issues came up, simply say, okay, it's late, but I'm claiming do not take the penalty because it was beyond my control. Normally for students, I wouldn't do that because undergraduates are great at finding excuses about what happened. You know, they have grandparents who have passed away 3 or 4 times and probably, you know, just came back and gone again and came back and gone again or something. So it's a whole different world there. So I'm used to teaching in that environment, but it's pleasant to have the honor system. So what I was getting ready to talk about was there a question? No, just scratching the head. That's good. We're going to be talking about using the JavaCup tool. And think of this as very similar in its organization to what you saw earlier with JLEX. So as you'll see, there's a section where I can say, here's the various pieces of code I want included in the generated parser. Another spot that says, here are some options that I want to specify for you. For example, when you return a token or a read a token, here's how to do it. Here's how to call the scanner, and here's what the definitions will be like. It's also going to be the case, as you'll see, that you're going to declare variables. But unlike variables that are normally int or char or whatever, you're going to declare things that are non-terminals or terminals. If they're terminals, you already know exactly what their type is. It's exactly what the scanner said it was. So a comma is a CSX token. An identifier is a CSX identifier token. You also have non-terminals, and those will normally map to AST nodes. If you're unclear at what AST node I have in mind, just ask. It's not something I'm keeping secret from you. I had, for example, a Piazza earlier that said, I'm processing a read. What sort of node is appropriate for a read? Turns out that it's the read node, as you might have guessed. But if you're unsure, ask, and we'll simply point you to it. In some cases, we use AS nodes slightly unexpectedly, and I can explain why. But it's not my intention to have you figure out AST nodes. Those are things that have been designed in advance, and something where if you design it yourself, you might get it off just enough. And sometimes it's one of these tiny off by one type errors that works now, but later down in phases 4 or 5, something may fail because, oh my gosh, I forgot about this case or that. And rather than have that happen, I've done the design for the AST nodes in advance. And that, by the way, is why the assignment is thicker than it would otherwise be. In a lot of cases, here's the AST nodes. You want to read them, and at some point you want to check them off and say, okay, this guy goes with this production, that guy goes with that production, etc. It's also going to be the case that almost all your effort is in one section of the specification. Just like in Project 2, it was regular expressions and Java code. In this case, it'll be productions and Java code. So for each production, you say, well, I've got to go ahead and find a match for this guy, and here it is. So I'm talking about that, and that just put me in mind of something, so let me go to another document. Here we go. Yeah, I was just talking about that document. Let's bump that sucker up a bit. Well, maybe that was too much. Let's find out. Yeah, that just barely fits. So what I want to do is, I was talking about the grammar. What did I do? Yeah, well, I undid it. Yeah, one other point I wanted to make. So what we were looking at, recall, was the grammar. And I was just, what set me to mind, I was just, what? I'm doing some kind of gestures. Oh, I didn't want that, did I? Sorry about that, guys. I didn't want it that small. So we'll undo that. Yeah. So here's the case where I was talking about the if then and if then else parts. And this is these are the two productions, one of which you may want to remove temporarily just to get the thing to go ahead and parse. So just going down here, notice we have a variety of statements, and I wanted to mention that in passing. So we have while loops, which are pretty familiar. We have assignments. And each of these, if you're not familiar with what these are called, that'll be a key to making sure you understand what AST node. So this is an assignment, so the ASG, which is an abbreviation for assignment. This is increment and decrement. This is read and print. This is a method call. Return or return expression, break, continue. And this is a block which contains field decals and statements. I get a question in this, and let me explain why this is in there. Optional semi is, as the name kind of hints, an optional semicolon. That means it can be generating, optional semi can generate an honest gosh semicolon token, or it can decide not to. Now what this is an example of people changing a grammar slightly to be a little bit more user-friendly. And the issue is precisely when you have something that has open and closed braces, do you really need a semicolon also? Many people are used to it, but others are not. So for example, if I say int f blah close and then char, just a pair of methods that I'm outlining. Do I need a semicolon here or not? Notice normally we have semicolons separating things like declarations or statements. But in case of a method, because the thing always has to end with a semicolon, you really don't need it. This thing really says I'm the end of a method because you can't have anything outside the body of a method that is inside the method. It's either in or out. But a lot of people love to put semicolons at the end of things. So in this case, all I've done is make the grammar a little more user-friendly by saying it really doesn't matter in the big picture. If you want to put semicolons in there because they look more natural to you, go ahead and do it. Because you don't really need them, if you want to drop it because you're a purist, you may do that too. Now, people always ask me, well, what sort of AST do I put for optional semi? What do you imagine would be the answer on that? Nothing. It's just a delimiter. So most things have ASTs, but not absolutely everything has to have an AST. And in this case, it's there, again, just to be friendly to users. And people do that from time to time in grammars. They simply say people are used to writing in this form, like putting semicolons at the end of statements. I discussed in an earlier lecture, in early languages, semicolons were not statement terminators, they were statement separators. The difference being the last statement in a body, a block, whatever, did not get a semicolon because there was nothing to separate it from. These days, people more or less tend to think of semicolon as ending a statement, just like a dot or a period ends a sentence, and therefore they routinely put them in. So things have changed, and this is a similar issue here. Since I'm used to putting semicolons at the ends of things, I'll allow it, but it's just there to be user-friendly. So it's friendly to the user, not so friendly to the compiler writer, but it's not really a big deal. So you'll have a couple of productions that generate no AST at all. So it's a situation, the optional semicolon, you'll never look at the content of an optional semicolon. Was it there or not? Who cares? Maybe you'll give style points or something, but we're not going to. So that sort of explains that in advance. Something else I wanted to talk about was when we get down to expressions, we have this huge list of stuff. And first time you see this, you say, gosh, Fisher hates me. He's giving me all this garbage that I have to worry about. You know, expressions and terms and factors, and PRI stands for primary and unary and unit. And finally, we get down to, I think, even names. Now, why are all these things in there? They're in there for only one reason, and that's actually to make your life easier. All this junk up above with various operators is there precisely to enforce operator precedence. You don't have to worry about it. The grammar, if implemented as I specified, will automatically make things group properly. What do I mean by that? Well, Java and C have all sorts of rules about who takes precedence over whom. So if it's like in the military, you have to learn the ranking system. You know, generals come first, and then colonels, and then majors, and then captains, and lieutenants, and then sergeants of the various levels, and corporals, and privates, and all that. So it doesn't mean much to you, but I mean, if you're in the military, you fail to salute the wrong guy, you could be in trouble. And there's all sorts of variations. There's full colonels and lieutenant colonels, bird colonels, and light colonels, and things like that. So there's all these rules, and if you could sort of just drink something or other and learn them, it'd be cool. In a sense, that's what we've done here, and let me explain what we're doing. It turns out I've already showed you the things like multiplication and addition. And in fact, these rules will guarantee that when the tree is built, it's always the case that the multiplication is grouped together first. That means in this expression, do the multiplication first and then do the addition. You always have the option as a programmer, if you want the other association, to force it with parentheses. So parentheses will let you force the other ordering. But it turns out it's way deeper than that. And actually, there's a fair amount of thought that's gone into the design. So for example, if I have something like A double equals. Notice that could really be interpreted two ways. One way is preferred over the other, and we would hope that the grammar would enforce that. So if I write it down this way, what do you think I probably mean? And again, I could have put parentheses, but I'm lazy, and if I know the language, I really don't need to. So what would you, if just reading that, what would you say that is computing? A is equal to B plus C. And that exactly is what the grammar does. So it's a situation here that this interpretation, which you could kind of force with parentheses, is not the one you want, because if nothing else, if I compare A against B, it's going to give me a Boolean. And in our language, unless you do a cast, Boolean is not allowed to be added to C, which is probably an integer since you're doing addition. So only one really kind of makes sense. And it turns out that if you read it there, you want addition or arithmetic operations to happen before comparison. But it even gets deeper than that. If I have something like how do I want that one interpreted? So now I have comparison. So I say A equals B and C equals D. Oh, sorry. So So which way do I want that one interpreted? That is, do I want the and done first or the comparison done first? The comparison. And again, if you think about it, if I did it the wrong way, I get all sorts of garbage. I'm anding together something that's not even a Boolean, and then comparing it against an integer, even if that were allowed. Remember, it's really not allowed because the fact that you're not allowed to have multiple, without parentheses, you're not allowed to associate relational operators. They got to be done one at a time in forced order. So you have all the stuff that you want to work properly, but there's no magic. We have to somehow enforce this. There's nothing that when Earth was created on whatever day it was, that it had to be that this was interpreted that way. So how do we do this? It turns out if you look at the grammar and try it, the grammar forces the appropriate association. And it actually goes deeper than that. There's something I have. Yeah, look at this monster here. Not A plus B times C equal 3 or D not equal to F. And the implicit parenthesization is that, and that it's sort of the one that makes sense. You do the comparison, you do the Boolean operators very late, you do arithmetics before you do comparisons, and in the case of a unary operator, those are always applied first. So shriek is not, and that's presumably applied to a Boolean. So it's not by magic that this grouping just falls out of the grammar. We've worked on the grammar and made it all happen. And the reason we then have all these levels is to make sure that one group of operators has priority over the other. And absent explicit parenthesization, you won't get the wrong ordering. So these are in there for a reason, and just leave them. What this means is you're going to have a number of productions that are remarkably simple, similar. But that's okay. That means you figure out how to do it once and then just repeat it. So that means up here you're going to have something that takes two subtrees for factors and creates a binary op node, binary operation node, and plugs in the fact that the operator is whatever the token code is for less than or equal. This one will be virtually identical. You'll wire together into the same subtree, but just change the token code. Similarly, if I go up here, I'll wire together. So all these guys, they have binary operators, all this expressions, comparison, plus and minus, star and slash, until I get to unary operators. Those are all binary operator nodes. In fact, you might want to mark that on your paper, that all these guys are going to be translated almost identically. So you say, well, why in the world am I have all these duplications? And it's because the stratification handles this association problem with making sure that operators are applied in the correct order. So each level gives it a chance. So what happens is the lower down you are, the situation there, let's look up here. So it turns out, notice the lower down you are, the higher your priority, sort of just the opposite. So usually the top quality people get to the front of the auditorium or the front of the classroom, which is certainly the case here. And as you go up, lower and lower priority. And it turns out that the grammar just forces that. So the reason it's in there is to make your life easier. I could compress this down to everything is expression compared with operator. But then you'd have to go ahead and figure, well, who gets priority over whom? Do I take this association or that? And it'd be a lot more work. So that's the explanation for that. In fact, now that we've talked you through the grammar, are there any questions remaining on the grammar in terms of what this is doing or why is something like it is? So it ought to be the case you're not necessarily comfortable with absolutely every production here, but most of them should make kind of sense. This intentionally looks a lot like Java, and Java looks a lot like C and C++ for that matter. So things are intentionally looking the same, and in general, if things look like a concept you're familiar with, they'll be implemented and defined in a very similar way. Just getting ahead of ourselves, we have methods. Well, if you have many methods in the class, how do you figure out where to start execution? What's the magic thing done in Java? There's a special name, main, and main typically is the one you start execution on. And sure enough, this doesn't show up yet because we haven't gotten to semantic processing, but there'll be a rule that says you've got to have a method named main in your class, and that's where execution will begin. It turns out that sort of by implication, and not only will main be in there, but it'll be the last method in a class. Why is it going to be the last method in the class? Well, it turns out we don't allow forward references. That is, if you're at a particular point in your program, you're not allowed to reference things defined later. So you want main to have access to everything, because who knows what main's going to do? It may want to call this method or that. It may want to touch this field or that. So by coming last, everything else has already been displayed, and therefore it has access to everything. So just by implication of the fact that no forward references, main must exist, and it must be the very last method in the class. Now, it turns out Java is a little more liberal on that, a little bit more permissive. We're simply trying to make your life easier. We could go to those full-scale rules, but then you have to worry about, is this thing defined here, or maybe it's defined in future? You have to go and look at all the definitions and then reprocess it, doing all the definitions, using all the uses. That's the way real languages do it, but it's extra effort, and I don't think you learn all that much extra, except that we made life harder for you than we could have. So any questions on the grammar that we have? So what you want to do certainly is have a copy of that, and probably at some stage you'll be making little notes about AST nodes, you know, how things link together, etc. But that is for sure your starting point. Okay, one other thing there then, since I have this up, is I've been talking about CSX Lite, and I'll be getting, here are all the various class, AST class nodes, and you'll want to have this in front of you just to check this has the names of the fields, their types, etc., etc. When you're programming, you'll just need that to make sure that the declarations match the types. So lots of that stuff. What I'm scrolling down to, if I find it, is CSX Lite. Ah, here she is. So I just barely got it entirely on the screen. So this is the startup that I've given you. So these productions with the ASTs and the scanner and all the rest are already in the startup package I've given you. And when we go around and start touring around what's going on, these will be your starting points. So notice this has an if then, for example. If you wanted to use if then else, it'd be a fairly minor change. Pull the if then, put in the if then else. Here are the cases what I was just talking about earlier. Namely, we have four expressions, and these things don't do much in the way of operator precedence, because at this stage, that's not really all that relevant. But as you look at each of these four, they'll be handled about the same way. And when I showed you previously that many lines of code, all building binary operators, use what I've done here as a starting point. So just enough here to be a semi-plausible language, and you'll get to see how the various kinds of ASTs are built. To the extent possible, I've used the same AST nodes in CSX Lite as CSX, so you can carry the work across. The major difference is, for the actual root of the tree, the program, CSX, remember, has a class and it has a name. This thing has just brackets without a class and without a name, so the root has to change. You go from a CSX Lite node to a CSX node to represent the roots of the two different trees. That's part of that transition I talked about earlier on. So we'll be working from this, and I'll be giving some examples, and we'll actually go through the specification. And one of the ways to get started then is start taking this and start expanding it out by adding new statement types, new declarations, whatever. But again, at some point, you'll have to make the transition. We have to go from being a caterpillar to a butterfly, and that'll mean at some stage this is no longer a CSX Lite structure, it's a CSX. And at that stage, you'll have not just fields and statements, you'll have methods, and all statements appear inside methods. So you'll have to make that transition. It's a question up to you when you do it earlier or later, but I suggest at least early on, stick with CSX Lite just to put a few new things in to get the hang of it. So yeah, I go ahead and do this, I know how to scan these guys, etc. And once you're convinced that it's not too hard to add new AST nodes, then it's just a matter of going through there and getting them all done and testing them all out. So let's go back to this guy. So as I was saying before I interrupted myself, it's the case that we have structures very much like JLEX, where we have some situations where we simply say, here's some code to add to the generated parser in this case. There are situations where we give directives saying, here's how we want you to scan, or here's what we want you to consider the root, or I'm sorry, not the root, but the start symbol of the grammar. And the key part, the part where you'll spend most of your effort, will be a series of productions followed by Java code that say, when you recognize this production, go ahead and execute this Java code, which in most cases will call and construct a new AST node, filling in the subtrees with components already parsed in the right-hand side of that production. So here's an example where I can specify a package if I care to, saying, here's the name of the package. And I can use imports, like in this case, Java Cup runtime is the runtime support for the parser, so that normally will be included. Don't worry too much about that. That should already be in the startup package I've given you. Code additions, you can say that I want this code to be added in to where my actions are. So if the actions would like to call methods or classes that don't already exist, you can define them right here and say, here's some classes that contain some utility methods and just call them as if they were predefined. Parser code is stuff that's generated with the parser for things like how to call the scanner. Initialization code that says, here's how I want to initialize my structures when the parse first begins. And scan with, this is certainly something we want. Say, how do we scan? Well, we scan by calling the scanner we've already implemented in part two implementation. Declarations, these you'll certainly need. As I was saying, these are kind of like the idea of declaring something to be a string or an integer or a Boolean. But in this case, since we're in the land of grammars, the two main distinctions are terminals and non-terminals. Terminals are not too bad because in this particular case, you simply use the classes I've already given you and you've already chosen as part of your scanner. So you might say, here are terminals that belong to this class, like CSX token, and just simply give their name separated by commas. So the comma symbol is going to be a CSX token, the left paren, the right paren, the left bracket, the right bracket, on and on. For those particular tokens that have special classes, like not just CSX token, but CSX identifier token, you would say, here's a terminal that's a CSX identifier token, and of course, it's the terminal symbol that represents an identifier. So all you need to do there is go through all the tokens that you already know how to generate, determine there must be a declaration for each of those, give the right class, and give their name as it appears in the grammar. In some cases, if the name is changed slightly, like int literal to integer literal or something, you have to make sure that's all uniform. But those are just minor things. What you're also going to need to do is down below have non-terminals. Yeah, question? Yeah, that'll work. You got to be careful there that it has to have access to those declarations, but those should be available in the scanner. So when we see the sample there, where you see the spot wherever we declare all my predefined tokens, make sure your stuff is also there. So what happens here is for each non-terminal, you're going to have to say, I'm going to have a type associated with that. That will normally be an AST node of some sort. So in the middle of my assignment, I gave you all those AST nodes. I don't expect you're going to need to create a new one of those. Be careful if you do, because again, later phases better know about them. I won't know about them, so you'll, you know, so you can add stuff, but you know it's at your own peril in the sense of putting up with it. But it's certainly doable, and if you want to do extra credit, in fact, this is a good time to talk about extra credit. On the basis of Project One, not very many people need it, but people are always interested in doing more. This would be a spot where if you always said to yourself, gee, I wish I had a language that had this feature or that, this would be a spot to add it. So if there was a particular kind of feature that you really would love to play with, as long as you have some notion of how you'll eventually implement it, I mean, you can't have a magic thing that says pick the winner or something. So you give it a list of this week's football games or baseball games and pick the winner. In fact, pick the winner. I saw something in a paper that there are certain embarrassments that are really, really bad. And one of those is a situation that came up there. This is spring training time. And it turns out that in spring training baseball, the very first games a number of teams play is against a college team. So you get a professional baseball team playing a college team. And I saw in the paper just the other day, guess what happened? The professional team lost to a college team. And this is actually a Division II college team. It was the Philadelphia Phillies, who aren't a very good team this year, and they've been selling off their players left, right, and center. But can you imagine the embarrassment? I mean, the sort of situation like, you know, going to elementary school and having the elementary kid tell you, this is the way it is, and he's right and you're wrong. I mean, so if you ever go, you know, to show and tell or career day or something, did you bring students out here for career day? I mean, you know, little 7 or 8 or 9 year olds who eventually be Epic employees. Okay, yeah. This is your own kids. They don't bring in busloads of kids from neighboring school. So they do that on campus all the time. I say to myself, my God, those freshmen are getting younger and younger. Situation there, but they know, but they have situations to bring in the college and so on. But bring your kids to work day is a cool idea, so I'm glad they do that. So what was I talking? Oh yeah, so it was the case that the ultimate embarrassment is there to, in this case, have a professional baseball club lose not to a double A team or a triple A team, but a college team and a Division II college team at that. So it's a situation where you'd like to avoid that. So what we're going to be doing then is for each of the non-terminals, and again, I've given you the ones in the grammar, if you decide to add new features, this is a spot where you might add new non-terminals. You could even go back and add new terminal symbols and update your scanner. But if you had some cool ideas of what you'd like to add, this would be a nice try. And certainly it's a case where, as I was saying, if you understand how something is going to work, so that in future you can have some situation, this is how the code would execute. It would try this or try that or something. It's a good extra credit assignment, and you'll get to learn more about programming languages. So make a note now, if you want to do that, this is a spot where you start paying attention. So for the existing non-terminals, you'll have to give a class name. And as I said, that'll be the AST node associated with a particular non-terminal. Hopefully the names are close enough that you can figure out what that's going to be. But if you're unsure, just go ahead and ask me or ask the TA. We'll tell you. It's not anything we want to keep obscure. In fact, I'll just go and look at my solution and say, here's what I use, you go ahead and use it too. So in this particular case, you can see the names are such that statement node would obviously be something you'd use with a statement, expert node is something you use with an expert that is an expression, and on and on. So the names are meant to be something they're pretty easy to understand. This is the spot where you'll do most of your actual effort. So what's going to happen is you're going to have productions. They look a little bit different, but that's only because we have to transliterate from some symbols that don't exist in the standard ASCII character set. So the thing on the left is a non-terminal. This colon, colon, equal is simply an arrow. Arrows don't exist on most keyboards, so colon, colon, equal is an alternative that people have used. Name one, name two, etc. are the various symbols in the production. They can be terminals or non-terminals or any combination. If I have a lambda production with nothing at all these symbols disappear and I simply have the action. So that means, what do I match? Nothing. And when you match nothing, go ahead and do this bit of code. Now, getting ahead of myself, it's kind of amazing this all works, because how do you match nothing? The trouble is it's way too easy. Nothing here, nothing there, nothing, nothing, nothing. You'd be tempted to match nothing all the time to an unlimited extent. But the parser is smart enough to only match nothing when nothing is the only alternative. It sounds a little funny, but I mean, just get a sense of how powerful this is, because there will be some productions. For example, you can say, I have a choice of having some statements. One of my choices is I have no statements. So I could, for example, have a body that had just declarations and no statements. Was that useful or not? I'm not so sure, but it's possible. So if it'd be a situation that says, here's where I expect to find statements, the parser says, there aren't any. So in that particular case, you'd execute a production that says the statements goes to nothing, that is lambda. But again, lambda is not a standard symbol, so they use nothing. And all you would have is an action. The action actually might do something like create a null node saying, here's a placeholder that said you had the option of doing statements and you chose not to. So we put a marker there saying you had null statements that I looked at it. It's like this page intentionally blank I talked about earlier. Something had an option of being there, you chose not to. The action will be Java code, and I'll get down to that in a minute. And the semicolon is simply a terminator. In this case, we're terminating a production. productions can be long enough and complex enough, they may span several lines. So we simply say, when we have a semicolon, that ends this particular production. If I have a variety of productions with the same left-hand side, I can use the OR bar. That simply saves me the trouble of rewriting the left-hand side symbol several times. So this would say name could be this production or that production, etc., with, again, a semicolon terminating the whole bunch. The actions are Java code. Typically, they'll be to either build an AST or to carry forward an existing AST from a child to a parent, that is, from a right-hand side to a left-hand side. But occasionally, you'll have nothing at all, like that optional semicolon. So if you see a couple of those where you say, okay, I matched it, but it has no meaning at all. It was just in there to keep the users happy. What do I do? Nothing. I matched it. It's done. It's out of there. And that's similar to matching white space or the rest as you did in your project too. Sometimes you match something just to get past it, and it doesn't really create anything, so you don't need to return anything. So don't be too shocked if you do that. So let's take a look at an example. Oh, yeah, one more thing is when I build an AST as part of the right-hand side processing, where do I sign it? It's got to go somewhere else. It'd be lost. So the convention they use is result is a magic built-in name that says, here's a spot that's going to hold the result. That'll typically be the left-hand side of the production until somebody wants it. When I parse the entire program, result will be returned as the result pointing to the root of the AST of the whole program back to the caller. And that's how you'll be able to then get access to the AST to pretty print it or process it in some way. So let's also talk about the suffix. Suppose I have a number of symbols and I want to say, I want this guy. I could try to point out his name, but a symbol may appear more than once with the same name. So in this particular case, the notation they use is they put a suffix. It doesn't have to be a single letter. And that gives you a way of putting a name on something. So if we had something that was more two-dimensional or color-oriented, this thing might just simply be a different color. But the notion is whenever I have a symbol on the right-hand side and I want to point to it, I want to mention it, I can simply put a colon and an identifier, a single letter or multiple letters, to give it a name. So in this case, I'm showing you how you produce, we process the main program, the start statement for the entire program. This, again, is in CSX Lite. Remember, that is a left brace. What was the token symbol for left brace? L brace. What was the token name for a right brace? R brace. And what is inside the braces? A non-terminal that generates statements. So it turns out in this case, I want to be able to grab something about the L brace. That means the L brace has already been parsed, but it's already been scanned. And why do I care about that? Well, what's one of the good things your scanner did when it created tokens? It put line numbers and column numbers in there. Why did it do that? Because when I build the AST, I'm going to want to remember the line number and the column number for references. If I give an error message and say, error, the assignment statement is illegal, it helps if I say what line number it is, or in some case, you know, some reference to it. So I can say, error, assignment statement on line 10 is illegal, something like that. Where did the 10 come from? Well, it would be part of the token, in this case for the assignment, the left-hand side, and I grab the line number and column number for the target of the assignment and say that's the starting point of the assignment and that's where I'll reference it. So if a statement spans several lines, we'll point to the beginning of it. That's pretty standard notation. So we'll do that normally. There'll be one case where we won't, and I'll point that out when I get to it. So this is not a 1, this is an L, and this is S, and I'm just L for left, S for statements. And what I do is I say, what do I want to do on this? This is something that is creating an AST node. In fact, it's creating the root of the AST tree. Well, creating the root, where did all the rest come from? The answer is all the rest has already been parsed and converted into AST format by the code that processed statements. When this thing is matched, it says, hey, I've seen an L brace. I've seen all the tokens that comprise a list of statements. Might have been only a few, or it might have been hundreds or thousands or millions. Doesn't really matter. And an R brace. And the entire tree associated with the entire body of the CSX Lite program statements has already been created. All I have to do is wire it in one more time up into the ultimate parent, which is the CSX Lite node. So I say, here's what I want to do. I want to create a new CSX Lite node. I go back and look at the definition of CSX Lite node, and what does it take? In this case, it takes one subtree, namely statements. Notice the LBrace and LBrace have no semantic content other than a line number, so I don't use them very much. So this guy will have one child, namely the AST for the entire list of statements that are its body. And it says, well, I have to have a line number and column number for the entire program. So I'm going to say the line number and column number I use will be where the left brace was, because that was the very beginning of the program. Normally, that'll be line one, column one, but it won't always. Why won't it always be line one, column one? Comments. That's right, and that's exactly right. So comments were thrown away. That's true, but they still had this effect of associating different line numbers to where the symbols were. So the comments are not in the program, but their residual effect, that fact they changed the line number and column number, were in there. So I'm going to grab the line number and column number. That's part of the constructor, and that's going to build me the root of the tree. I'm going to put it to result, and when the parse is all over, result will be associated with prog, and that'll be returned to the caller. And if you want to look at that, go and look at P3. We'll probably look at that a little later. P3 is a Project 3 main, and that's the thing that starts the whole operation. And it will actually call the parser, and when the parser comes back, it'll grab a pointer to the root of that entire subtree and give you access to it for pretty printing, unparsing, type checking, code generation, whatever. So the takeaway on this is you started with this particular line. Just grab that out of the CSX light. Transliterate it. Prog is prog. Arrow becomes double colon equal. I have to look up in the token list what is it that left brace and right brace are called. Spell them correctly. Statements is probably the same. That's statements. And then add my code to say take the subtrees already been built, build the bigger tree associated with this production, and return it via result to the left-hand side. And that's what we'll do over and over, as you'll see shortly. So one of the things we need to do is also tell the parser where to begin processing. So there's a start with statement. In this case, prog is the start symbol for our CSX light, so we start with it. So we've seen a little bit of it. Let's go ahead now and look at the whole thing. So this is a Java Cup specification for light. And this is a little bit there. Notice here I use program instead of prog. That's one of these little differences that occasionally hammer you. So be careful on that. That's just laziness of not being routine and uniform. So a couple of things to look forward to. Here's one of those lambdas. So we'll have to see how that's handled. It'll also be the case that we have to see how expressions are handled and single identifiers. So what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and look at the CSX light first on the screen, and then we'll actually go ahead and get into Eclipse and see it. So you're allowed to have comments, and these are slash star comments. I guess you're also allowed to have slash slash style comments because this is Java land. So we have some preliminaries, and this stuff you can probably copy verbatim. So let's look at this. It says, I want to be sure to import the Java Cup runtime. That's because that's where some auxiliary routines for the parser are to be found. The parser code says, here's what I want you to essentially do in the parser. And what this stuff is something that you can copy verbatim. This is how I'm going to handle syntax errors. So occasionally, there'll be a syntax error. It's probably you're doing a test and you didn't quite type the program correctly because there's really not much to be found out by parsing incorrect programs other than you'll get an error message. So in this case, copy this. It says, I'm going to have a routine called syntax error, and it's going to take a token, and you could edit this if you wanted a little bit, CSX syntax error at line so-and-so. And what I do is I go ahead and get that token and extract the line number. So now I finally had a use for that line number. I said, hey, you had a parse error at line 7 because the token I could not parse had line number wired into it by the scanner. I say, what initialization do I need? In this particular case, I don't need any. If down the line you decide you want some initialization for some auxiliary structures, here's a spot where you can put initialization code. That'll be executed once when you begin the parse. And how do I scan? Well, I'm going to go ahead and return a call to scanner.next token. Scanner is a class I've already created, and it calls the JLEX-generated scanner. So this stuff is probably going to stay pretty much the same. I very much doubt you'll change much, maybe not change anything. here's where you'll probably start adding. This stuff is valid. You'll start adding to it. So in this particular case, the terminals are the tokens from the scanner. So remember, there's an identifier token, so we call that identifier, semi, L paren, R paren, blah, 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 blah. If this gets too long, you can have multiple lines. So in this case, this was getting long, so I created another one. If you want and have a line that's already working, you can add extras. But these should be the names of tokens you already know about from Project 2. I then do, as I showed you a bit ago, say, where do I want the parse to begin? I want to start parsing with prog. So I've changed program to prog to be uniform. This is the stuff I talked about just a moment ago that goes ahead and extracts the AST for the statements, wires it into a CSX light node, and returns it ultimately to the caller or the parser. Let's look at this one. This is the one that says statements can be a single statement followed by multiple statements. Now I have two ASTs. So I can imagine this coming in. I have statements, goes to a single statement, followed by additional statements. There we go. Each of those has created a subtree. So effectively, I have two subtrees, and I'll kind of draw these as triangles, roughly. These should not be thought of as pyramids. Think of these as kind of Christmas trees or something, something narrow on the top, broad toward the bottom. So each of these, I need a pointer to them. So notice what I do in this case is I call this guy S1 and this guy S2. Nothing magic about those names, statements 1 and statements 2. Again, they could be longer if you wanted to. That gives me a way of saying, here's a reference to that tree and there's a reference to that tree. I don't know what's in the tree. Somebody else has built it. It's their job to do it right. And I say, what am I going to do? Well, it turns out the left-hand side says I'm a statements. So it means I probably want to create a statements node. Sure enough, I do. So it says, please give me a new statements node. It's got two subtrees, one for the statement, the other for the statements. So those will both be passed as parameters. And I need a line number for the whole thing. So since we read left to right, top down, it'll be the case that I'll extract the line number from statement, which comes first. So in the list of statements, it'll be a pointer to the very first statement in the list. And now what's happened is I've created a statements node. And that has two references to subtrees. And this whole thing is returned via an assignment to result to statements. What'll happen is if there's another place that statements was used, for example, up here, I could then take this subtree and link it into a bigger tree. And I'll have a running example of that in a bit. But the takeaway here is your job at each production is nice and easy. You don't have to solve the whole problem. The symbols on the right-hand side have already been parsed or scanned properly. And you have references to them by just simply going ahead and giving them a name. The name is at the right end instead of left end, but that's just a minor issue. And you can then call a constructor. And the constructor will then go ahead and build the new AST using their children. Let's continue on. Oh, here's our null node that we talked about. So here's the null node where we had lambda. So this said it's a possibility that I had statements goes to lambda. Now again, what do we do with lambda? We could try to return a null reference. I recommend against that because the problem with the null reference is if you don't check before you use a reference, you get a termination error in Java. So what I have instead is even if something is empty, I create a special kind of node for it called the null node, and I link to it. So that means if an AST has two children, it always has two honest-to-gosh children. I can visit the left, visit the right. Maybe something will happen, maybe it won't, but it does that uniformly. So it says, okay, I need to have a null node for statements. For statements node. But what the heck is that called? You can look it up, but I've given you a clever little gimmick here. Each time I want a node that can have a null version, there is a field inside that class definition called .null, and that'll give you the appropriate type of the null node for that particular statements or that particular type. So there's a null expr node, there's a null statements node, there's a null this node, and a null that node, lots of them. So to stop from going crazy, you say, I need a statements node. How do I know that? Well, I know it because, hey, there's statements. So this guy's going to be a statements node that happens to be null. I know they exist, but again, exactly what they're called, I don't know. So I simply say, I'll take the name of statements node and append the dot null. That'll go into the class and pick out an already allocated example of that. What this means is I'm reusing null nodes. Why would I reuse null nodes? Because they're all the same. They're nothing. It's like one blank page piece of paper is the same as another. So instead of creating more and more blank nodes, null nodes, I simply say, for this particular class, here it is. They have absolutely no information, not even line number or column numbers, because they have no content. So I can always point to the same thing, but null nodes will always do the same thing. So in that case, I can share them. But this is really just a way for you to make your life a little easier. Say, I need a null node. There's lots of those suckers. Which one do I use? Simply say, well, I would normally want a statements node, so give me the null version of statements node. And it'll just go ahead and give you the right type and a pre-allocated copy. So continuing on, we have now statement. And now we have two different kinds of statements, the if statement and the assignment statement. So again, one of the first things I have to say is, here's a production that's an assignment. What is it? It's an identifier, the assignment operator, an expression, and a semicolon. So I say to myself, what particular AST node goes with this guy? And it turns out that it's the assignment node. Again, if you don't know, check. But again, the naming should be such that it's not too hard to decipher. And in this particular case, I say, well, look at the ASG node, and what does it have to have? Well, assignments have two parts, the left-hand side, which is typically a variable, and the right-hand side, which is typically an expression. So sure enough, I have an identifier, ident, and I put ID as a way to reference it. I say expr, and I'll call that E for expr. The assignment and semi, they have to be there, but they won't be in the AST. The assignment is in there because it's called an assignment node, so it's like kind of inheriting your parent's name. Ooh. What happened here? Well, this guy probably went to sleep, huh? Okay, cool. Just went to sleep. So in this particular case, I look at the assignment node and say, it's got to have two children. So one is the identifier, so I put an ID on it to grab it. The other is an expr, so I put an XE for grabbing that. And I have to say, where does the assignment statement begin? Well, you read the assignment statement left to right, so the first thing you see is the target variable. So I grab the identifier's line number and column number. So an assignment starts where the target of the assignment starts. Typically, it's leftmost symbol, but occasionally it'll be something else, and I'll explain that to you in a moment. Here's an if statement. Remember, this is just an if-then, but an if-then-else is not much different. In fact, it's virtually identical. So in this case, I have the if statement. I grab its name, I, because I want to use that as my line number and column number. LParn isn't too interesting. Expr, I have to have that in the AST. LRightParn, and since this is just an if-then, I simply have one statements, call that S. What do? I create an if-then node, but it turns out the if-then node in full CSX has an else part. So in this case, all we're going to do is what I showed you a little bit earlier in the lecture. Namely, I can think of an if-then as being an if-then-else that always has the null else part. That's precisely what I'm doing here. I say an if-then node has an expression, it has a then part, and has an else part. But the else part in this simple language always is null. So I say, well, I need a null node for it. So this is a statements node because its type is a statement. And therefore, statement node.null is a reference to a null statement node, saying the else part is not there in this particular case. And again, the line number and the column number are the line number and column number of the if. Let's continue down to expressions. So here's a case where these two are almost identical. They only differ in one's a plus and one's a minus. And I have the form is a left expression, an operator, and a right expression. And I guess in this case, it's not even an expression. It's an identifier because of our simple grammar. So what I'm creating is a binary op node, and it takes a left child, a right child. It also takes a code. What is the code? It's the scanner code saying, which kind of operator is it? Now, if I was doing this slightly better, but if I was not in the land of JLEX, I might have created an enumeration. And I could create an enumeration for all the various kinds of operators that exist. But instead of doing that, I've simply gone ahead and for uniformity says, we've already given a code to each operator. It's an integer rather than an enumeration value. But in this particular case, it's simpler to do it this way, and we will. So we go ahead and do that. And wait a minute, here's something that I just changed from what I previously did. Normally, I say the leftmost symbol is where I begin a particular construct. In this case, I'm grabbing the line number and column number of the operator. And why is that? Well, it turns out if you think about operators, operators are really a funny kind of function, aren't they? And if you go deeply into languages, and I write down something like A plus B, that's written, assuming I can show it to you right there, in what's called infix form. But it's the case that if you really think about an operator, it's really just a function. Now, if I had a function of something else, I had a function, for example, something called function sum, where I summed up some values, what would come first is the name of the operator. So in this case, I had sum. And then the operands would be the parameters. In particular, if I was to complain about A plus B, I want to say expression A plus B has the wrong operands. What would I point to? If I pointed the operands, it's not at all clear which operator I'm happy with. So this thing is really an operator. It's written in this form, but conceptually, it's in that form. Namely, what's more important is I'm an operator, in this case, the sum operator, the plus operator, and I have a couple of operands, which are my left and right children, the two operands. So although it's written in this form, why? Because that's the way mathematics conventionally does it. When we actually get around to programming it, it's going to be essentially called as if it were a function, with the operator name coming first. So it turns out that if I want to give a line number and a column number to an expression, the operator is the appropriate guy to complain about. So I would say, error, this operator has an illegal left operand. It might be the case I was trying to add A, and A was of type Boolean, for example. And in our language, you can't add Booleans together. You can go ahead and cast a Boolean into an integer, getting a 0 or a 1, and then add it. But in this case, we force you to cast to make clear that's really what you want to do, and it's not just you forgot to type and messed up. So in this particular case, I want to say error plus has illegal left operand. Or I could even be more precise, error plus operator may not have a Boolean as its left operand. But which one? I may have a lot of pluses in the same context. So I want to go ahead and point to the one I'm unhappy with, and therefore I grab its line number and column number. So normally we use the leftmost symbol, but in case of operators, we don't, because of what I just said. They have this infix form, but they're really the center of the expression is really the key guy as far as interpreting that expression. So in this case, we go ahead and we return a new binary op node. It's got a left value. It's got an integer. That's the code. It's got a right value and line number and column numbers. And that goes ahead and builds me an AST tree. The cool part is notice that for this particular alternative, the minus, it's a situation where I change virtually nothing. All that changes is I have the code for a minus, and I think that's it. I have the minus up here. I changed sim.minus, and I think the rest is the same. So when you're doing operators, a lot of them are going to be very similar. Once you get one right, you can do the rest of them and just run through that fraction of the program pretty quickly. One other thing I have is this situation where an expression can be an identifier. Here's the case where, unlike the others, I don't do a new. Why? Well, notice what I'm saying is the expression is just a single identifier, but I've already created the AST for the identifier, whatever it might be, and nothing has changed. It's simply saying I had a very simple form of an expression, a single identifier. So in this case, by doing result gets I grab whatever AST I had and carry it forward. So the expression and the identifier have the same AST because they're essentially two different names for the same thing. And one last thing I have here is I have a non-terminal ident and a terminal identifier. This allows me then to just localize where I create identifier nodes in one place. In a lot of situations, identifiers appear in many places. In this simple example, I say ident is the subtree in non-terminal form of a terminal identifier. So in this case, well, why am I using a name node instead of an identifier node? It turns out is that when identifiers appear in full CSX, they may be subscripted. The way I tell a subscripted variable from a non-subscripted variable is whether or not it has an associated expression that represents the index into the array. If that guy is empty, it's a simple identifier. If he's not empty, it's an identifier along with a subscript. So I'm anticipating that in the full language, I can have an identifier with or without a subscript, and that's called a name node. It's the name of a value, either a single variable or an indexed value inside of an array. So in this case, I create a new identifier node just for the identifier, and I grab its text and a line number and column number, and then I make it a subchild. So let's look at that, because I did that in two steps. Oh, and I finish my thought and we'll, there we are, some fresh paper. So essentially what we do is we create first an identifier node, and that just has the name of the identifier in it. And that's what this new right here does. But notice what I'm doing is I can have a new, it returns a reference to this node, and I simply create an upper node called the name node, and that has one reference to the identifier, and because I know this has no subscript, the other child is null. Well, what kind of null? Well, normally that will be a type expression, so I say expr node, give me your version of a null node, and plug that in there, and what I return back is that. And I do that so that when you extend to full CSX, you'll have name nodes where identifiers normally are and anticipate the possibility of having an index or not. So that's why I do that. It's a little odd, but it saves you less rewriting in future. So let's take a break, and we'll be back about 8 and one last session, and we'll be done.